Rat.
Rose.
No.
Hello, Star Trek fans, and welcome back to Warp Trails. This is the RetroZap Podcast Network show devoted to Star Trek. I'm your host, Dennis Keithley, and with me, as always, is my wife, co-host, and most favorite Star Trek fan, Beth.
Happy podcasting day, everyone.
All right. We will be discussing Face the Strange, which is the fourth episode of Season 5 of Discovery. In this episode, it will be a full spoiler discussion. This was written by Sean Cochran, directed by Lee Rose. In some ways, this is a classic time travel episode for Star Trek. And then there's some themes of getting to know the crew and personal connections and the like, and working through bad beginnings and bad experiences to get where you are. What did you think about this episode overall, Beth?
I enjoyed it. I always like a good time travel. I mean, I know this wasn't, as you said, a purely time travel episode, but time hijinks always amuse me, and I enjoyed this episode. How about you?
I liked it quite a bit, and it might be my favorite of season five so far, I think.
Yeah, it's a solid episode.
Yeah, it was fun, and it was straightforward, and I think it had a pretty clear theme that they did a good job of exploring with. They walked the fine line, I think, without beating you head over the head with it, but at the same time demonstrating it for you, which can be difficult to do, I think, at times. And I think sometimes Discovery's writing in the past has been a little opaque when it comes to that. So, and you know, the other thing about, okay, just an observation, there's a whole lot less whispering going on in Discovery this season compared to last seasons. I was noticing that when I was rewatching this today. And while, and that has been one of my complaints, is it's always been dark and it's hard to hear everybody. But they have something to say. They go someplace else so that they can say it and not have to whisper so much. Now watch, the next episode will be the everyone whispering for a solid hour in a cave somewhere. But am I alone in that observation, or have you noticed that?
No, I have. Now that you say it, I think you're right. There has been a lot. There has been less of the whispering. Yeah, no, and I have enjoyed the lighting. The lighting in Discovery has always kind of been weird to me, and I get it because it's the technology, but like engineering, for example, will be kind of a dark space where the light comes up from the tables, which again, that's what it would be. But sometimes that really poorly lights very attractive people. I mean, I'm like, wow, you have beautiful people in this room and you are doing them a disservice, but that's what it would be like. So,
indeed. Yeah. So, again, we already mentioned this is a bit of a time travel episode, but to pick up the story, they are at the coordinates they got from Janal in the past episode, and it's supposed to contain the next clue as to what they're supposed to put together for to find the progenitors, except for they're there and they find nothing, and then all of a sudden the bug that was planted on Adira goes into action, and it sabotages the ship, and I believe at some point Raynar calls this a Crenum chronophage.
And yes. It is a, do you remember the Crenum?
I do not. Go ahead and put that. Describe that for everybody.
They were introduced in Voyager in Year of Hell. I don't know if you remember.
Okay. Yes, I didn't know that's what they were called. Okay. Okay. And anyways, these bugs can be used to basically disable a ship by randomly cycling it through time. They are available on the black market. In fact, we see Maul and Locke acquire one from a black market dealer at the very beginning of this episode. And it, the story proceeds to the bridge where Raynar is cutting down everyone's ideas. And finally, Michael pulls him into the ready room to tell him this behavior is unacceptable. And just as they are getting ready to beam to the bridge because there is a strange energy fluctuation, the ship experiences this time cycling, but because they were transporting at the time, they are unaffected. And Stamets is also unaffected because of his tardigrade DNA, which keeps him outside of time. Don't think I ever really understood that or how that works for him, but it doesn't matter because it works for the story. in the end, with a little help from Zora and other things they pick up along the way, they manage to persuade the crew of Discovery from the time that Lorca was in command to help them put into place their plan to fix everything. And they end up back in the present, where Raynar has learned his lesson about connections, and they are set to resume looking for the clues to where the progenitor's tech is. Did I leave anything major out of that brief summary?
No, I think that hit all the main plot points in that summary. Yeah, go.
Okay. So let's get Locke and Maul out of the way first. As I said, this episode starts with them meeting with somebody who is some sort of black market dealer. And this is the sale of the bug that we saw planted on Adira last episode. And he's getting ready to try and hike up the price on them because this item's on demand. But they beat him to the punch by poisoning the latinum that they gave him. And so he dies from the poison and they get the bug. And Maul says a couple of interesting things there that, you know, after Locke says that he feels like the walls are closing in on them. Maul is talking about how they're going to stay one step ahead of Discovery now. They'll get this technology. They'll no longer have a bounty on them. They'll be free. So what do you make of all that she's saying?
I think we'll get some more backstory to that. I think it's just sort of they're planting some seeds for her backstory, which I liked. I actually really liked Locke in this. He's always, not always, he hasn't been in that many episodes, but he's been the willing to go along with it character. But one of the things I really liked the way they did with this scene is that, you know, Locke is saying, you know, maybe this is enough, kind of doing the, I don't want to do this anymore. To your point, the walls are kind of closing in. But then when that dealer, that poison dealer, like grabs at his leg and is like gargling, Locke just kind of kicks him off. Mm-hmm. It's very dismissive. And I liked that character beat for him because I really didn't. What it really, to me, confirmed is that Locke wants to be there. And it's not just because he likes Maul. It's because this is a life that he has chosen. And it's not just for her. And I don't know. I may be overthinking it, but I really liked it.
Is there anything to make of the statement that Maul said that they coated this latinum and the poison that the seller sold Emerald Chain, and it was a poison that was used on people like Maul? Is there a clue to be picked up from that I'm not getting?
I'm not getting it either. So I don't know. I mean, maybe, but the Emerald Chain kind of, I don't feel like what we know of the Emerald Chain is that they're particular about any one group that they particularly harass. I mean, mm-hmm. So okay. Maybe, but.
Yeah. Well, maybe that, like you said, maybe they're planting a seed for a future episode here as we get some of her backstory. Okay. So let's pick things up on the bridge. The little critter bug is roaming around the ship, and then we're on the bridge and they're trying to figure out what's happening because they're at the coordinates and there's no base within 2 parsecs and there's nothing there that they can find. And Rhys makes a suggestion that Locke and Maul may be waiting for Discovery to lead them to the next clue. And Raynar dismisses this. And it's kind of the culmination of a number of dismissive comments from Raynar, and Michael has enough of it and asks him to politely meet her in her ready room. What'd you think about this scene?
I don't want to say it amused me, but it amused me because, you know, the rule of leadership is that you don't dress down one of your subordinates in front of the rest of the team. But really, with her going, could you meet me in the ready room? It was pretty much clear that Raynor was about to get his butt chewed. And one, I agree he deserved it. There was nothing wrong with Rhys's comment. And in fact, frankly, he was right. Rhys was right. And, you know, I also think her saying that made it clear to the crew that, no, I'm not going to chew Raynor out in front of you, but you all need to be aware that I also don't think this is acceptable. So I'm going to take him in another room where you all know I'm chewing him out, mm-hmm. but you're not going to hear me say it. So I don't know that that's going to get like her leadership 101 points, but I thought it needed to be done and I liked it for Reese, I guess. What about you?
I thought it was about as well as it could be handled there.
Yeah.
Because it couldn't go on that bridge. And Michael, you know, first thing she says to him when they get to her ride room, this is unacceptable. And I expect participation from my crew. And I don't discourage them there. That's how we work as a team. That's how we keep them invested, et cetera. And then his response is that, you know, familiarity leads to complacency. This is a red directive and things have changed, you know, with the burn, and he's cleaned all these past fears. And he's also goes on to kind of lord his experience over her about, you know, that he's gone through these before. And if he had embraced this type of familiarity with his crew, they would have been dead 100 times over. And when she goes on to say, you know, I understand this is a difficult transition. So his response is, you know, oh, don't give me, I know what you're going through, BS. And he realizes he stepped over a line, takes a second to recover for it and apologizes. And he'll end up telling her at the end of this episode, you've given me more patience than I deserve. And this is a big moment of that patience.
Oh, totally true. Because you can even say, you can see as the words are leaving Rainer's mouth that he realizes that he needs to pull them back in and he can't. And I thought Burnham handled that extremely well. I think she's been handling him extremely well. I still like Rainer as a character. And in fact, despite this scene being, I was like, Rainer, come on, get it together. Mm-hmm. I liked him in pretty much the entire rest of the episode. And I think he's going to continue to be a favorite character. I actually, and in fact, if we don't, because I would actually be very happy if we move on from this story beat of Rainer needing to adjust, because I don't, he can always be the grumpy old man on the bridge. Like that would make me, that would be fine. And I don't mind if he slips back, but the more often he suggest, you know, what if my way's right? It's like, you, Rainer, are you going to mutiny? Like what's going on here?
Yeah, I'm with you. I certainly hope that there's no backsliding for this character after this episode. I feel that was the strength of this episode. He learned Michael's lesson through action as opposed through a lecture over the course of this. He saw the value in forming that connection with the crew. And it is, in fact, that he knew something that he learned in 20 words or less. It was like 23 or whatever from Commander Reese in the previous episode that allowed him to make the connection that was the breakthrough in the climactic scene of this episode. And he goes so far as to tell Michael at the end of this, it's not lost on me how we pulled this off. And it's because he was able to form those connections. And then he praises Reese at the end of the episode because his suspicion was correct. So it really would be a backslide if they go back to this type of behavior for Rainer. That being said, I'll be perfectly fine as he's a bit curmudgeon-y throughout series.
I hope he is.
In that he has disagreements with Michael, but they can't be over this issue anymore.
Right.
About familiarity and connections with the crew. I, you know, I didn't dislike him before this episode, but I really grew to like him and appreciate him over the course of this episode, because I forget what the actor's name is, but he did such a fantastic job playing a guy that had it in him to do these things, to make these connections, but just didn't want to.
Right.
And then when he was called to do it, he was able to step up to the task.
Yeah. He call him Keith Rennie.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So, so they're having this confrontation, and that's when they get the notification. I think it was OO from the bridge telling them that some sort of transmission, unauthorized transmission, has been sent, and they have this alert. We see some flashes, and they're not traveling through time. This also comes right after Stamets noticed the bug in engineering as it's crawling around the walls and then embeds itself behind one of the panels. So now we get a series of scenes where they're jumping through time. And this was kind of fun. You know, you and I were just talking about this in the past two episodes, or three episodes, really, how we only kind of remember what happened in Discovery with in the broad strokes. And this is like a crash course in the broad strokes of what happened in the previous four seasons of Discovery here. And so they immediately find themselves in the wormhole as Discovery is traveling from the past to the quote unquote present. And there's Michael out ahead of the ship as the Red Angel. That was pretty cool. I enjoyed that.
No, I thought that was cool too. I also liked, and this is something Star Trek, and I get it. It just sort of depends on who the captain is and what the show's doing. But each captain has had very different views on the temporal prime directive. And I really liked that Burnham and Rayner were much, much more in alliance with it. And I think part of it is, you know, Janeway's like, oh gosh, time travel, I hate it. And the idea is, you know, for Janeway, the temporal war was future. For Rayner and Michael, it's past. And so I liked that, you know, everyone was unconscious and Rayner was like, what is happening here? Michael's like, we got to go. No one can see us. And I thought that was just a really good point. I thought it was terrifying when they were transporting and they were like flickering in and out. That shot was good. I'm glad it was short, but I was like, oh gosh, what's going to happen to them now?
So help me understand something, because I'm not sure. I like this episode a lot, and I don't, and I'm doing some nerdy nitpicking on things when it comes down to it, but they did bring up the temporal prime directive, which you can't do anything that would possibly change the future. I get that. Appreciate that. But then at some point they seem to figure out that their actions wouldn't change the future as long as they managed to destroy this Krenim chronophage. Am I right about that? Because, you know, that's kind of at one point, you know, skipping ahead when Michael's talking to Arium and, you know, Michael apologizes for having to tell her that. Arium's like, yo, don't apologize. If you manage to successfully pull this off, then I'm not going to remember it anyway.
Right. So the idea is kind of with the bug, everything is within a jump. Because they're going to fix it within the jump, the bug, the time will reset. And so if they had done that and not gotten it done in the jump, then they would have changed history. But as long as anything that they do to change the future happens within a jump, then they are okay and get something of a free pass.
I think I get it.
What the rule is. And I understand it in the way I understand that popping a warp bubble and the relativity slows down and what that all means. But since none of it's real anyway, it's never totally going to make sense. Cause it's just like within this universe, it is true. And it's relatively consistent within the universe.
Yeah. It just seemed as the longer this episode went on, the less concerned they got with the temporal prime directive. And when they're in the past, when it was Lorca's ship and, you know, it had only been weeks since Michael had been brought on board. Now, I understand someone was out of necessity. Michael didn't plan on encountering herself, but she did. And so there had to be something to do. And then they were dealing with a very small amount of time. They had to make some tough decisions, but the flexibility they seemed to embrace with the temporal prime directive just grew the longer the episode went on.
Yes. Well, needs way out.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the second place they end up is back on Earth while Discovery was in dry dock and it was under construction. And they find a very surprised crewman there in the captain's writing room. And, you know, they just pick up on his lead, which is, you know, says, I thought the inspection was tomorrow. Surprise. Yep. So, he says, maybe you all should go to deck 7 last. And we'll tell the foreman that's where we're going first. And, you know, if you fail to prepare, then prepare to fail. And Rayner's like, I always hated that statement. So it was.
I do too. Yeah.
And then from there, they end up with the battle with Control, which was, like I said, the broad strokes of what happened in Discovery leading up to this season. And this is where they figure out it's the Krenim chronophage. And we get the explanation of what that is. And then they figure out that it must have been Maul and Locke that left it. And they, because they know a transmission was sent, and so it was a perfect trap in that regard. And then they, it's when they figure out that they need to find Stamets, as he lives outside of time. But of course, Stamets at this moment is in sickbay because he's been impaled, and he's begging Culber to let him go back to engineering and to fix this. And Culber's just like not having it at all.
Well, and then, you know, Stamets is asking about Zora and asking, you know, all these things that, that Hugh doesn't understand. I thought it was a good scene from them both. Because, you know, it's like, I don't, you know, Hugh's like, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, what's going on?
Yeah. And then the next, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't remember how that scene panned out originally, and it doesn't really matter because the dialogue was different, but I thought they did a kind of, they did a good job making me feel like that was that scene again.
Yeah. My memory was when that was happening, Culber had recovered from having previously died, and they've been having that relationship problem throughout this. And then Culber was telling Stamets basically that, you know, where one of them's going, they're both going, and he's going to take care of him. Like, you're kind of like my home type of a statement there. So yeah, definitely different from than what happened there. So from there, they go to the back to the future. It's still in the past compared to the current present is, but this is when Osira of the Emerald Chain attacks the ship. And the best part of this was the encounter between Rayner and Reno. And, you know, because they're going hand to hand with these helmeted Orions from the Emerald Chain. And just when they seem to run out of luck, Reno comes to the rescue. Michael has to run off and hide because she would be recognized in this situation. And Raynar pretends that he's temporarily assigned to the ship. And there's just a fun interaction there about what is it? Some sort of martini that she enjoys.
Yep. Has to be ice cold.
Right. And so that next time when we get a previously unseen era of Star Trek, which is 30 years in the future, the long and the short of it is that Discovery is abandoned other than the presence of Zora, and she is degrading and fast because at some point Maul and Locke had found the progenitor technology, sold it to the highest bidder, which was the Breen Imperium. And they then attacked Federation HQ shortly after Discovery had been rescued. And basically the Federation gets wiped out at this point. And 30 years goes by, and there's been nothing left of this. So this seems to be giving us again yet another clue about the Breen, who've come up over the previous three episodes and mentions that, you know, they're out there. That's a force that continuously gets referenced. And of course we know them from the past in Deep Space Nine. What did you think about Zora's plight and all of this?
Oh, poor Zora. I mean, Zora as depressed person was very sad. You know, my first watch through, I was just kind of like, you know, I get it that you're sad and that everyone, you know, you cared about died. It did make me wonder, and I think we talked about it before we started recording, you know, how much is Zora actually in charge of the ship? But it was a very much like, you know, she's sitting alone in the dark, kind of being sad. She was very much a depressed person. And then I liked that when Burnham and Rayner, you know, come and it's like, hey, it's really us and we can, you know, maybe change it, that Zora, you know, perked up enough to participate. And I mean, I don't know how else they were going to figure out that pattern of time cycling in a way that made any sense to anybody. And that worked as well as anything else.
Oh, yeah.
But I felt for Zora. I really did.
Yeah. I mean, she'd been alone for so long and she's gotten used to being an integral part of the crew because, you know, that was a whole episode where she was basically asked to join the crew. And so she's the last one left and she's been dreaming and hallucinating in the past. And she asks if this is another dream and she doesn't believe it's real. Something you had asked earlier, before we were recording, is about why did Zora have the view screen blocked? Had you thought about that anymore?
I I mean, maybe because it helps her not look at it. I'm just very confused. And you know what? I don't really need to totally understand Zora. I mean, I just don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like she senses things outside the ship, but maybe she, you know, maybe it was just a reminder that she didn't want to look. I mean,
yeah, because they did have to convince her to open the view screen there. So maybe it was a matter of closing her eyes to the, because you and I were also part of that conversation. She's like, well, can she just not leave on her own?
Right.
Take the ship and leave. And so that I don't quite understand either. But I guess where would she go? If the Bream taking everything over, is there any place that she can go?
And that's it too. Like maybe she is hiding because maybe she, mm-hmm. if, you know, if she acts like a dead ship, maybe she gets left alone and maybe that it's for protection.
Yeah. I wonder if they're going to do anything with that by the end of the season. Cause Zora has been evolving now for a couple seasons here on Discovery. So
it's really weird. Cause there was a Discovery short where somebody comes across Discovery that's been abandoned and has a conversation with Zora. I mean, this is kind of the second time we've had Discovery as abandoned vessel in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know if there's anything to make of it or they don't want to do anything with it, but it's sort of a fun thing to consider. I don't know.
Right. So the next jump puts Stamets back in engineering, and I'm not entirely clear when this occurs, but I think it's before Discovery comes into the future. And so this is in the past at some point, and he has this conversation with Reno, and she's, because it seems like he's maybe spaced out and is no longer aware of what's going on with to her. And so he covers for that, but then he's like, well, while I've got you here, let me run something by you, because I don't know I'm going to have you here again. He's just fumbling around with this and runs by his theory about how to fix everything. And then she says, yeah, that's basically right, as long as you figure in some sort of distortions. I can't remember exactly what she said, but she's shown up now in a couple episodes this season, but she's still criminally underused, I think, in this.
It must be a scheduling thing with her. Yeah. It just must be kind of like Whoopi Goldberg in The Next Generation. When her schedule makes her available, we do something with her. Because yes, yeah. Reno is a treasure of a character. And I am 100% convinced that Reno was totally aware that Stamets was having time issues and she was just willing to play along.
Yeah. And that was the funny thing. She asked him, like, are you currently trapped in a time loop? And he's like, what? No. And he's like, I'm just kidding with you, but I'm with you. I thought that was going to come into play later in this episode, that somehow she was going to have remembered from a previous encounter or something, but
it didn't. But I was beginning to wonder that too. And that's another reason why I kind of think it's whenever they can get the actor, because
mm-hmm.
the fact that Reno was, you know, the one who saved Rainer and the one who helped Stamets, like both very like things that Reno would do, but they didn't have to be Reno.
This is true. Well, then when Michael pokes her head up from some Jeffrey's tube, I guess, and, you know, whispers to Stamets that she's there, he fakes a spore breach and basically gets everyone to leave engineering. He's like, yeah, Kamu, do you want a mushroom growing in your lung? And what's funny about that is, you know, what he uses this tactic a couple times over the rest of this episode, but then he goes, makes some comments like, I'm kind of disappointed that the rest of my staff doesn't realize this isn't a real thing. And it's just something he was using as an excuse. I mean, good on the fly thinking on his part.
I did like the one towards the end when he, you know, it was early in the, you know, he was like, just, I'm very cranky and need to be alone. And everyone fled fading. And Rainer was like, they left faster that time.
Yeah, and his response was, well, this was pre-tardigrade DNA me. And I was pretty grumpy and cranky back then. So, yeah. And then, you know, they give him the data from Zora and he figures out how to build a chronoton stabilizer. They don't have time to do anything about it, so they end up in their next jump period. This is sometime in season 4 when they were looking for whatever was causing the trouble up beyond the boundaries of the galaxy, I am assuming. And this is while Michael and Booker still have a relationship. She has to go back to her quarters to get some, I can't remember what the name of the liquid is, but it's out of the holo emitter in her quarters. And she does that, but as she's leaving, Booker comes in and it's a very tender moment between the two of them.
It is very sweet. Yeah.
And he's trying to encourage her, you know, like, you know, change is the only way we get anything done, anything happens. And, you know, he tells her that, you know, she was made for this job, and he tells her he loves her, and she responds, but, you know, she's kind of uncomfortable with all this.
Yeah. Do you think they're going to get back together, or do you think they are done?
I think it's at least going to come up before the end of the season, I think. But what about you?
Yeah, I would like them to get back together. I'd like them as a couple. And actually, I think that scene reminded me of how much I do like them as a couple.
Mm-hmm. And it also reminded me how good a job they are doing acting out the tension between these characters in the six, you know, because 6 months have passed. And it's like, wow, they really have chemistry there. So they managed to do that. They get the stuff. And this is when they end up in the past, when it's still Lorca's ship. And I think we were both disappointed that he didn't show up.
I was like, oh, we're going to get Isaacs. This is going to be amazing. And then Stamets said he was off the ship. And
yeah, we both collectively were like, aw, groaned when that happened. It's like, oh, I guess not. But the cameo we did get here was Irem. And,
which was great.
Yeah. And I can't remember exactly if she was a cybernetic being or if she was a cyborg or what the situation was, but she was very robotic in her movements. And this was the key. This ends up being the key for Michael convincing the crew that she is who she says she is, and they need to do what she says. But we kind of covered that already. But we get the Michael versus Michael fight when, you know, future Michael is heading on the lift up to the bridge and runs into her past self, who is not buying that this is Michael from the future at all. And they go one on one. Future Michael ends up knocking her out with Vulcan nerve pinch. I thought that was an pretty impressive fight. I'm not exactly sure how they pulled that off.
I'm not sure how they did, but it was amazing. That one was an amazing fight. And the one with the, you know, Emerald Chain was amazing. Those two were just, the fight choreography was amazing. I have no idea. And, you know, those past and present or past and future, I don't know, the same character kind of fighting each other, that's just got to be impossible to I mean, it's obviously not impossible because they did it, but it's got to be a hugely challenging piece of something to film. And I thought it was incredibly well done. Do you think, I think it was Michael's courier time that made her beat her past self, that basically she's gotten more fighting techniques?
I hadn't thought about that. That's a good point, though. Yeah, that might be it. Because it was a pretty evenly matched fight when it came down it. And it really came down to her having that opportunity to get that Vulcan nerve pinch in that sealed it, because they were pretty much just blocking everything that the other one had. I mean, past Michael got a blow in on future Michael's face at one point, but it was a good fight. I certainly liked it. And the other thing that I liked about this, that I think might have been one of the most subtle aspects of this episode, was that future Michael, Captain Michael, got to look at her past self. And this comes up at the end of the episode. And, you know, she's basically telling her unconscious self, it's like, I know this is like the most difficult time of your life and that it seems impossible right now, but don't give up, because you can get to that captain's chair. It doesn't seem like there's a possible path to that, but keep going. And you know, that's that looking back and seeing how far she came, I think was just kind of a nice message and, you know, to put out there.
Mm-hmm. No, I really did like it. And yeah, I thought it was a cool piece. I also, I know you don't really work in an office with a bunch of people anymore, but I don't know that I could stand in my office and prove that I knew things, super personal things about my coworkers, and convince them I was from the future, even if I were from the future.
That would be really hard without getting sent to HR, I think. I mean, you're right. I don't work in a big office anymore. It's just me and a couple other people. And I suppose if I had to convince them, maybe. But if I had been in any of my previous offices, then yeah, that could be a big challenge to do with and be convincing in the past. I'm sorry, and be convincing at the same time about that. But that scene between Rainar and Rhys and past Michael was quite good, because you know, future Michael couldn't make it down there in time, which I think is one of the entire reasons that they came up with the whole thing that the site to site transporting doesn't work. Well, I mean, one, the ship is different, so it doesn't have that inside, and it's not going to work, period. But I think it was precisely for this plot point, so that Rainar could have that moment of connection and reach Rhys about his love of starships, especially the Constitution class, and get to Michael about, you know, I know when you were first came on this ship, you wanted to run away as soon as you stepped foot on the bridge because you didn't feel like Starfleet deserved to have a mutineer on the bridge. You couldn't do that to them. But, you know, look, you know, you get past that and you kept going. And that's what made that whole thing work. And it was a well-acted scene and carried out extremely well.
Mm-hmm. I also really liked the when he was talking to Stamets and was doing, you know, Stamets calls him out on, you know, putting a pause on grumpy candor. Mm-hmm. And they, and I liked it for a couple of reasons. One, because, I mean, Stamets really was, I mean, Michael and Rainer were helping. I should be consistent with names. Burnham and Rainer were helping. But it was up to Stamets to kind of build the thing. And it was a team effort. But, you know, Stamets is basically like, it's really hard to have to save the universe all the time. And I think that was a good moment. I also liked the, and I thought it was interesting. I liked the line, you know, let's, you know, when Rainer says, you know, how can I help you right now? You are not alone. What can I do right now? And then that was really a good way to get Stamets to reset, but then also said that line about, you know, let's show them that a couple of old dogs know the best tricks, which I thought, I was like, on one hand, Rainer at least appears much older than Stamets. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in terms of technical age, because of the travel through time, Stamets is incredibly much older than Rainer. And I kind of wonder how the Federation, how the present sees the current Discovery crew.
That's, yeah, yeah. There's some obvious jokes that they can be made there that they haven't been doing in there, because these are, you know, octocentenarians. I mean, it's
right,
you know, I'm not sure if I'm even saying that correctly, but you know, they're all over 800 years old at this point. And but to your point there, when he says, you know, let's show them how a couple of old dogs know the best tricks, he says Paul, he uses his name, and when almost before this he almost entirely calls people by their rank in this, and so he is making the connection. And then when he talks to Commander Rhys, who's Lieutenant Rhys at this point, he calls him Jen. You know, he says he calls him by his first name. So he is, he's getting it. He's understanding. Yeah, the familiarity can bring complacency, and Michael will admit to that, but it does allow for this larger world of problem solving for them to understand each other and work together in a way that they otherwise can't when you are on that professional distance that Rainar has been talking about in the past. This is not the most earth-shattering episode of Star Trek I've ever seen, but it is one of the better acted ones I've seen recently. And Rainar, I think, is largely responsible for that in this one, because he really does go through moments of regret, moments of overstepping his bounds, growth, and connecting and acknowledging what it is that he's learned and putting it into action. And it's an incredibly good character arc for this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So they get back to the future after enacting this whole warp scheme and breaking the warp bubble, which gives them time to destroy the phage before time catches up to it. And turns out they only ended up losing 6 hours because of it. And then they've learned that the dots they had sent out found a warp trail that disappears. Rainar praises Rhys's theories, and they are getting to work on solving this new mystery so they can figure out the current clue. That brings us to the end of the episode. Is there anything we haven't covered that you want to make sure we do before we go?
Well, I just have a couple of questions about the end, because it's very much like, let's solve the mystery. Mm-hmm. But aren't they now behind?
Yeah, I'm assuming they are. And I figured they're going to have to figure out this clue on their own. They might have to figure out, get around another act of sabotage by Locke and Maul, assuming that they found the clue. And then they're going to have to catch up. Or did Locke and Maul misinterpret another clue and are off on a wild goose chase again? So there's a lot of things that can happen from here. It's not clear what is going to happen next, though.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad it didn't end on a like a, oh my gosh, we're behind and this is all horrible. But I was like, y'all are awfully happy about being behind. I don't know. I really liked it. I really liked this episode, though. I was just a little confused about the end.
Well, I think the reason that they're happy is that when the future that they were afraid of happened like weeks after this. And so as opposed to losing weeks, they've lost 6 hours. And so there's a huge difference, and they have an opportunity to prevent the disastrous future that they saw.
Oh, okay. All right. That's a good read on it. And I would like to acknowledge that I was totally wrong that Maul put a tracker on Adira. That was not what
Well, we both said that last episode.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's a tracker. I was wrong.
Well, you were not 100% wrong, because that thing did send a signal to Maul and Locke to tell them where they are. So we weren't 100% right, but we were also not 100% wrong. I'm going to take the win.
But asking, tell me something about yourself that I couldn't read on your file was a very good question. We did say it was a good question last time.
Yes. He just needed to leave off the in 20 words or less.
Oh, for sure.
Part of the whole thing.
No, I thought it was a fun episode. I don't know that there's anything else. That's, you know, there are other things that happened in the episode, but I really do think the conversation Adira had with Gray was just to get the bug off Adira's uniform and into engineering. I don't know that there's anything more to be read from that. So,
because it was a repeat of what they already talked about. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, good episode. I liked it. Like I said, I think it might have been my favorite from the season so far. But with that, we'll conclude our discussion of episode 4 of season 5 of Discovery. We will be back soon with our discussion of episode 5 of season 5. But before we go, Beth, you want to remind everybody where we can be found on social media to the extent that we're actually there.
I was going
to
say, we pretend that we are on Twitter at Warp X at Warp Trails. We also pretend that we are occasionally on Instagram and Facebook at warptrails.pod. But seriously, guys, if you want to communicate with us about Star Trek, the way to do that is to get on the RetroZap Discord server, find the Warp Trails room, and discuss Star Trek with us. That is certainly where you are much more likely to find me. You are also likely to find me in several other of the rooms on the Discord server. And I highly recommend you come to Warp Trails and then check out the other options.
Indeed. And our show is part of the RetroZap Podcast Network. You can head over to RetroZap.com for all the other great podcasts and all of our past episodes. And actually, that's probably the easiest place to find them, since we are exclusive to the RetroZap Podcast feed and all the shows come out there, and these tend to get buried back in the queue. And with that, I want to thank you all for joining us. Live long and prosper, and we'll talk to you next time.
Take care, everybody.